First, let me just give you a very, very brief chronology of how many judges there were and how long the period is. This is not particularly complicated because most of the judges are given a certain, you're given the years of their reign and you just add up the years. There are a total of either 13 or 14 judges. You'll see why, because there is one name, we're not entirely certain if he is a judge or not. Apparently he was a folk hero, perhaps even a mythical figure. But we know there is Othniel ben Kenaz, who was the very first shofet after the death of Yehoshua, and he reigned for 40 years. He was succeeded by Ehud ben Gera, who, if you recall, he was the one that assassinated the corpulent king of Moab. And he is assigned an astounding reign of 80 years. Very, very unusual. Of course, he could have become a military hero at 20, and he just stayed around for a long time. Now, the next shofet is the one that we're not sure of. There's a fellow who's given the name Shamgar ben Anat. Now, Shamgar ben Anat is not described. He is not given the title shofet, nor is there any number of years that's assigned to his reign. It just mentions one thing about him, and it seems to be a foreshadowing of Shimshon. It says he killed 600 Philistines with an ox goad. That's a cattle prod. That he took a cattle prod, he killed 600 Philistines. Now, apparently, his heroism was regarded as so great that in the Song of Devorah, she makes reference to the heroism of Shamgar ben Anat. So apparently he was a very legendary figure, but it's not clear that he was a shofet, and in the standard chronologies of the period, as it appears in the Talmud, he is not assigned any number of years. You go straight from Ehud to the next one, and the next one, of course, is Devorah, the only female who's a shofetet, and we'll discuss Devorah a little later on. I just want to list the first. Devorah was a shofetet for 40 years. And we'll add up all the years afterwards. The fourth shofet is Gidon, 40 years. So these were fairly long reigns. And we'll talk about Devorah and Gidon because there's some very interesting and disturbing stories about, particularly about them. The fifth shofet is the only shofet who is a successor, in other words, the son of Gidon, by his concubine, was Abimelech, which interestingly enough is normally in the Torah as the name of a Philistine king. Of course, Abimelech is very apt. My father is king. Abimelech, his father was Gidon, and he ruled for 3 years, and he was eventually assassinated.
What is his name again?
Abimelech.
Abimelech.
That's 3 years. The sixth, seventh, the sixth is Tola, of which we're told nothing other than he ruled for 23 years. So these shoftim have no story at all about them. Yair ruled for 22 years. Again, we know nothing about him other than that he ruled.
The sixth was?
The sixth was Tola.
Are we already counting Shamgar then?
No, Shamgar ben Anat is not counted as a thing. He's not counted as a shoftim.
How do you spell
Tola? Tola is Tuf, Vav.
Tuf.
Tuf. Vav, Lamed, Ayin. Same word as a tolat, which is a worm.
Oh.
Mm. Yair, 22 years. Again, we know very little about them. But again, I'll go over the details as we go through. I just want to give you a list to give you an overall chronology. The next one is well known, again, in infamy, and that's Yiftach.
Oh, yeah.
And Yiftach, of course, is known as the one who said to God, the
come
first
down.
Thing that comes out of my house I will bring as an offering, and we'll discuss.
What happened to them?
Well, we'll discuss that. I'll get into the stories as we go through. I just want to give you a list first. The one, Yiftach is only 6 years. So although, it's very interesting. In other words, there are Shoftim who had a reign of many years, of which were given one sentence. And Yiftach, because of this particular incident, there's actually a great elaboration, even though he only ruled for 6 years. The next one is a shofet called Iftsan. Now, this is interesting. Iftsan, we're also told almost nothing in the book of Shoftim, other than he was a shofet for 7 years, and he had 30 sons and 30 daughters.
Mm-hmm.
He had 60 children. By the way, that's not the highest total. There's some other shoftim that were even higher. But what's fascinating is that in rabbinic identification, Iftsan is none other than Boaz, of the story of Ruth. So it's very, very interesting that in the book of Judges you would not get that sense at all. But in fact, the book of Judges begins by He Bimei Shifot HaShoftim, and it doesn't tell you which Shofet, but Chazal's interpretation is it was in the days of Ibtsan, and Ibtsan was also called Boaz. He had two names, and therefore Ibtsan was in fact Boaz. In fact, but we'll talk about this. According to one Midrash, all of his 30 sons and 30 daughters and sons-in-law, they all died. When Ruth and Naomi came back from Moab, Boaz was just coming back from the funeral of his last child. Okay. The next is Alon, of which we know nothing other than he ruled for 10 years. And then there's Avdon, of which we know virtually nothing. He ruled for 8 years. And Shimshon is the last of the Shoftim. He ruled for 20 years. Now, if you add up all of this, and this is really the purpose of my going over this, is the total years of Tekufat HaShoftim is 317 years, plus whatever years may or may not have existed with the Shamgar ben Anat. Now, the Shamgar ben Anat is the unknown figure, so the period might be extended somewhat. But at a minimum, if you just add up the years that are actually given in the book of Shoftim, we have 317 years. What do we mean? From the death of Yehoshua till, not the first king really, because remember, this takes us to the death, till the beginning, till the beginning of the book of Shoftim. So actually, the truth of the matter is, Eli, who is the high priest, may technically be the last Shofet, but that already brings us to the book of Shmuel. Right. But in terms of the book of Shoftim, we're covering a minimum period of 317 years. Now, there's one other thing we have to add. A number of these years, again, this is just taken from the book, a number of these years were under foreign occupation. Meaning, besides the fact that there were Canaanite pockets, of course, in Israel, that was always the case, but there were actually, the Israelites, the Bnei Yisrael, were actually ruled by foreign countries for a number of years. For example, of the 40 years of Othniel, of those 40 years, 8 years they were under the rule of a king called Kushan Rishathaim, and he was from Syria, Aram Naharaim. Remember, Aram Naharaim is Aram, Syria, Naharaim, between the two rivers. That is actually the ancestral home of Lavan, Rivka, Rachel, Aram Naharaim. So he came from that area, and he actually conquered the Israelite population for 8 years. That was during Othniel's reign. During Ehud's stewardship, for 18 years, the Jewish people were occupied by the Moabites. Now, the Moabites inherited the east bank of the Jordan. For the 40 years of Devorah's reign, the first 20 years, they were ruled by Yavin, a Canaanite. Yavin was a Canaanite king, the king of Hazor, whose general was Sisera. Okay, so 40 years of Devorah, 20 years, the first 20 years were under conquest. During Gidon, there were 7 years of Midianite oppression. Midian is from the south. So, again, if you add that up, that means, I'm sorry, and I should also add one other thing, that for 18 years, between Yair and Yiftach, there was Ammonite oppression. Now there's Ammon that oppressed them. So if you add up the years of foreign occupation, that is 71 years. So just to give you the numbers, the Tekufat HaShoftim, if we factor out Shamgar, who's unknown, we don't know if he was a Shofet or if his years were within other Shoftim, you have 317 years of Shoftim, and of those 317 years, 71 years, the Jewish populations were under foreign domination. Yep. Well, yeah, they're different. I'll tell you they're different. Okay, yeah, I see right away what they did. The historical problem is whether the years of occupation come out of the reigns of the judges or are within the reigns of the judges. So, for example, they count the 8 years of Kushan Rishathaim as 8 years, and then Othniel ben Kenaz as 40 years. And that's indeed plausible. But in the Seder Olam, the rabbinic chronology, the assumption is that the occupation years are within the reigns of the Shoftim. So So, for example, the total combined years of Kushan and Othniel would not be 48, according to Seder Olam, but they would be 40. And if you keep on collapsing that, that's where you'll get a discrepancy. So, you are raising a very good question, and that is whether the occupation is in addition to the years of the Shofet, or some of the years of the Shofet were under foreign occupation. That will give you a different chronology. Now, I will admit that the Sansino chronology actually fits the biblical verses better, but I'll tell you why the rabbinic chronology goes a different way. Because it is recorded in the book of Malachim, the book of Kings, that King Solomon built the temple, built the Beit HaMikdash, 480 years from the time the Jews left Egypt. This is a date that is recorded in Tanakh. Now, since the Jews wandered in the desert 40 years, it must have been 440 years from the time they entered the land of Israel. So the problem is this. If you're going to make the period of the Judges that much longer, you're going to have problems with the 440-year figure of the book, right?
Well, he knows. He knows
that's going to be an issue.
Well, there's 40 for King David.
Because King David had 40 years. No, so you're in trouble. In other words, if you work it with 317 years, it works out well, because you add Shmuel, and you add Shaul, and David, and everything else. And of course you have to add Yoshua. Remember, you have to also add Yoshua to the 317. If, on the other hand, you expand the period of the Judges by adding in the years of occupation, you're going to have more than 440 years by the building of the Beit HaMikdash. And because of this, the Seder Olam, Seder Olam is an interesting book. Seder Olam means the chronology of the world. This is a book from the time of the Mishnah, which sets out the rabbinic understanding of scriptural chronology. And the Seder Olam does take a definitive position that the years of foreign occupation are muvla, they are absorbed within the years of the Shoftim, as opposed to being separate periods. And that was primarily to get the 440-year chronology. In fact, to digress for a second, there's a very, very fascinating midrash that Rashi brings about this. You know, it says in Parshat V'Etchanan, which we read on the 9th of Av, in addition to the Torah reading, that when you dwell in the land for a very long time and you do evil, God will drive you out and destroy you, right? That's a prophecy of Galut. So it says, Ki tolid banim uvnei banim, when you have children in the land, V'no shantem ba'aretz, and you will have dwelt in the land a long time, God prophesies Galut. So Rashi says the following. Let's take the word V'no shantem, you have been old in the land, and let's add up its numerical equivalents. V'no shantem. So we have, let's add it up, without the Vav first. The Nun and the Vav is 56, 356, 406, 806, and 4846, and with the 6 is 852. Now, let's think about this. How many years were the Jewish people in the land of Israel from the time they entered until the Churban? Now you can figure this out, because we know the following. We know it's just two numbers. It says in the book of Kings that the Jews, that Shlomo built the temple 480 years after leaving Egypt, which we know is 440 years after they left the land. We know that the first temple stood for 410 years. So, from the entry to the land to the destruction of the temple was 850 years. Everyone understand that? Yeah. So consequently, Rashi says it was a midat harachamim that exiled us after 850 instead of 852, because if he would have waited till we became old in the land, which is the Gematria 852, the Pasuk says he will utterly destroy us. And therefore, there was a midat harachamim that the Galut occurred earlier than it should have occurred. Hikdim shtei shanim levino shantem. He made 2 years earlier than the Gematria of the Noshantim. And that is why it says that when Yaakov is running away from Esau, and Yaakov has the dream, right? Remember, Yaakov stops to sleep, and Rashi says the reason he stopped to sleep is God made the sun set earlier than it otherwise did, because God wanted Yaakov to stop at that spot. But the Midrashim say that it is the sudden darkness is an allusion to the Galut. Because just as the sun set earlier that day than it normally would, so too the Galut would come earlier than it should have, because God did not want us to fill our measure of sin, which would have necessitated an element of destruction. Which means, of course, again, this is just yet another example of how what is perceived as adversity and tragedy could often be to a person's ultimate benefit. The extra galut actually was our benefit, because it prevented us from reaching that level. So this idea of the 440 to 480, the 480 is a very, very important figure, because that is a linchpin for many, many computations of biblical chronology. Because, you know, that's a firm verse that says Shlomo built the temple 480 years from the time they left Egypt. And that is the basis of computing all sorts of things.
Shlomo thought about the sand.
The
total number I have, but this includes all the occupations, is 317 years. The occupations are 71 years. 71 years, and according to the Seder Olam, 71 years out of the 317. Not in addition, out of the 317.
What was the occupation of the
Aaron Yitzchak? Their period of being judges, mean?
The occupation.
No, the time they were occupied.
No, Yiftach and Avdan were not occupied. The occupation was not during their reigns. The occupations, the Kushan was during Otniel's reign. Eglon, Melech Moab was during Ehud's reign. Sisera and Yavin was during Deborah's reign. And Midian during Gideon's reign. And then there was Ammonite oppression. I should say there, between Yair and Yiftach, there was actually no Shofet at all for 18 years. So the Ammonite oppression was the only oppression where there was no Shofet. So between Yair and Yiftach, there is an 18-year hiatus. Yeah.
But can you actually swallow that in really 71 years of
Right.
I mean, where would that come in?
Yeah, so I think we would have to understand it that a shofet can also be described as reigning as a vassal subordinate. So for example, we could say, yeah, you were nominally the shofet, but your boss was that king out there. Because in the ancient world, it was fairly common. Even in modern World War II, it was that way. In other words, Vichy, France, and the like. In other words, there was a French government. The French government was getting its orders from Germany. So I guess Chazal would understand that this was the same thing. Whereas I will say that it's very, very difficult, especially if you take Deborah, for example. It says after Deborah's victory, the land was peaceful for 40 years. According to Seder Olam, that pasuk does not make sense, because 20 years of Deborah's reign, they were occupied by Sisera, and there really was only 20 years of peace, not 40 years. So it is very, very difficult. But, you know, as you say, you run into problems, because if you expand the period of the Shoftim, you're going to hit the wall with Shlomo HaMelech. And that seems to be a fixed date that we have to work with, because that is a definitive date that is given in Tanakh. So this is one example of biblical chronology that can give us a lot of trouble. And of course, if we add in Shamgar ben Anat, he's not given any of me. Now, maybe he was a shepherd for 60 years. Who knows? That would throw off the whole period. Well, we're not given his age. We're not given anybody's age, really. First of all, the idea could be the following: he could have done his great deed of assassinating, you know, the king of Moab as a very young man. Assassins can do things young. And then, you know, maybe since the land was relatively at peace, maybe he was more of an honorific figure. You know, he lived till 100. So he didn't necessarily have a lot to do at that point. In fact, of his amazingly long reign, the only detail we're given is that he assassinated a king. I mean, we're not told anything that he did the rest of the time. So it could be, you know, some shoftim were simply less active. And the point is this. Obviously, the Book of Shoftim as a book of history is a very incomplete book, because there are long periods of time that are just glossed over with no significant detail that is given. If we had to pick a dominant motif of this book, I think it's the moral degradation of a society without a centralized authority. And that's why the Book of Shoftim seems to go out of its way to emphasize that which is improper, that which is pathological. That's very, very interesting stories. I mean, some of them are very disheartening. We went over Pilegesh Begivah last week and the like. Then we'll look at Shimshon and other examples of extreme degradation. And it seems to be almost the introduction. And this is why we need a king, by telling you all of these. So Shoftim is really a jaundiced eye. It's really putting B'nai Yisrael, I think, in the worst light, almost deliberately, in order to demonstrate the need for a centralized,
so
centralized structure.
Shoftim? They were not Shoftim, though, as the commissioners or
the leaders. Well, you have to understand that the word Shoftim doesn't necessarily have the same meaning that it has, even in the Chumash, where a Shofet was an adjudicator of a dispute. Remember, we talk about when enemies are punished. We talk about God judging our enemies. So the Shoftim may very well have referred to God's agents in exacting vengeance on the oppressors of his people. In other words, a different use of the word shofet. Although I would have to say, in the case of Devorah, where it describes her as a shofet, that even before she led the war, it seems to clearly indicate she would adjudicate disputes between people. So that was really just the first thing I wanted to go over. That is just to give you a sense of the general chronology of the period, how many people there were. And I think we pointed out that the Shoftim are not hereditary offices in all of this list. There's only one aborted attempt to have a successor, and that is really a self-crowned successor. We're going to see as I get to the story. Abimelech, who was the son of Gidon, was not, as it were, made a successor by his father. He tried to usurp, like later with Absalom and David and the like, and that didn't work. He eventually was assassinated, and then they stopped the idea of heredity. And it also seems that the Shoftim did not necessarily, in other words, they did their job by leading the people into battle, and then they retired to become private citizens again. It was not necessarily a permanent type of office. You were the citizen judge who then went back into citizenship or retirement, like Cincinnatus in Rome, right? You kind of go back to plow the field. Yeah.
You said the Shoftim where they want to fight the enemy. The Shofet came up when somebody threatened Israel.
That's correct.
Yeah. Now, how come they remained a Shofet and didn't conquer the enemy and live under their belt?
Well, what happened was they would conquer and then they would be conquered. In other words, things were going back and forth. If you remember, the book describes in the beginning the pattern of, as the Jews were prosperous, they would turn back to idolatry. And then God would send an enemy to conquer them, and then they would repent and get a judge and drive away the enemy, and then they would go back into the same pattern. That's exactly what happened. It goes back and forth. Now, just to identify the enemies again, to be sure everyone knows these ancient people, because you know all of us, you have the Midianites, the Moabites, the Ammonites, everything sounds interchangeable after a while. Again, just so we know exactly who these nations are, Moab and Ammon are very specifically defined nations in the Torah. And the Moabites and the Ammonites are in fact related to us. They are the offspring of Lot's daughters. Right, this is recorded in the Chumash, that when Lot was saved from the destruction of the city of Sodom, Lot was alone with his two daughters. By the way, they were married already, but their sons-in-law, or their husband, had apparently died in Sodom because they were laughing at this idea that the city will be destroyed. And the Pasuk says that Lot is with his daughters in a mountain cave. This is in the Chumash. And the one daughter gets her father drunk and lies with him. And she becomes pregnant. And the second night, the second daughter gets him drunk again. Actually, Chazal say the second night, Lot is more responsible than the first night because he realized what happened. And she gets pregnant. And daughter number one has a child. And she calls that child Moav, which etymologically is related, May Av, from my father. And the second daughter has a child, and she calls that child Ammon, is my nation, Ami. Because I'll say that marginally the second daughter is a bit more reticent and sanua. She's more modest because she doesn't openly say, from my father. And these are the progenitors of the nations that became known as the Ammonites, Ammonim, and the Moabites. And they inhabited the east bank of the Yarden, but not the portion that was conquered by the 2.5 tribes, but a different portion. And in fact, if you look in the Torah, you see, going back to the Torah, before we even get to the book of Shoftim, that we have a love-hate relationship with the Moabites and the Ammonites. On one level, we were told that when we go to the land of Israel, we have to pass through land. We are not allowed to wage war with the Ammonites and the Moabites. If they give us permission to pass through, that is fine. If they do not give us permission to pass through, we have to circle their land. Why were we told not to wage war against them? Because God said, in the merit of Abraham, I have given Lot's descendants that land, and you are not allowed to take it from them. Now, the land that we did to Eivor Yarden was land that was occupied by Sichon, the king of the Amorites, from the seven nations of Canaan. But the land of Ammon and Moab we were not allowed to take. So on one hand, our attitude towards them is non-aggression. We're not allowed to wage an aggressive war against them. We're not allowed to conquer their territory. We have to let them keep their territory. If they don't let us, we gotta go around. We can't even walk through their land without their permission. There's a certain amount of respect that they get.
Can they marry?
Well, that's the next thing I'll mention. There's a certain amount of respect that they get because they are descended from Lot, who was Abraham's nephew. On the other hand, the Torah says, Lo yavo Ammoni u'moavi b'kal Hashem. That if an Ammonite or a Moabite, even if they desire to embrace Judaism, they want to become Jewish, they are not allowed to marry into the Jewish people. Now, we'll discuss about women in a second with the story of Ruth. That's a major issue. But before we get to that, the Torah says it. This is a pasuk. Now, why does it say, but look at the reason, why does it say you are not allowed to marry an Ammonite or a Moabite? It does not say because they were generated from incest. That might be forgivable in a way. Why is that? Because the Gemara tells us that the reason Lot's daughters were with him is because they see a world where they see the city of stone totally destroyed. They didn't know what's going on. They thought the world was destroyed. And they thought, there's no other way we can keep the world alive. And this is the old question. Who did Hevel marry? Who did Chase marry, I should say? Right? I mean, Hevel was killed, and Cain, even who did Cain marry is another question. Cain also married. But the point is, at some early point in the world's history, incest apparently was inevitable. Although, again, it's fascinating digressions. There is a very, very fascinating thought that I came across. This was an attempt to reconcile the scientific accounts of the years of the Earth with the 5760. That there are those who say, and this is there are Jewish sources for this, that Adam was not the first human creature. Adam was the first human creature with a divine soul. But there were other human-like creatures, call them Neanderthal man or whatever you want to call them, who in fact could have had intellect, but were not functioning.
That must be what Cain was
afraid of. That's right. And they even say, and that's what Cain means when Cain says, those who find me will kill me. Because, and in fact, that's even the reference going into this. It says the children of God marry the children of man. Mm-hmm. Now, most learn that refers to somehow the angels came down from heaven. But a very just interpretation is the descendants of Adam, who have the godly soul, are the children of God. And the intermingling with the other inferior forms of human life, that's the intermingling. And that's also why the life expectancies got cut down. Because those who came just from the children of God had a whole different interpretation. So according to this, there were all sorts of human-like people that you could have married, but they did not have the divine soul. Maybe they were intelligent, but they didn't have that divine soul. And that even explains why Adam was looking for a mate and he was not satisfied. and Chava had to be created. Now, how do you understand this? Was Adam thinking maybe I'll be with a duck or a lion? But if the idea was he was contemplating creatures that looked like him, and he thought perhaps they can be my mate, but then he realized there was some dimension that was missing. You know. So again, it's very, very fascinating, the whole possibility, and that also explains diversity of races, populations. It could explain all sorts of things if you posit a larger human population. But be it as it may, just in terms of the daughters of Lot, Rashi says very simply that they thought there was no one else around. So look what the Torah says. So why don't you marry a Moabite? Not because they were generated in incest, but because they refused to give you food and water when you're crossing the desert and you want entry. And they refused even to sell it to you. Therefore, don't marry. Now, what does that mean? So the commentaries explain that this refers to the idea that of cruelty, of lack of compassion, and of lack of gratitude, because after all, Abraham had done so many kindnesses for Lot. Meaning to say that a person who lacks compassion and lacks gratitude cannot belong to the Jewish people, because the most important midot that a Jew must have is that gratitude and compassion. In other words, it's not the incest. That is forgivable on some level. I mean, it's sin, of course, but that is a forgivable thing. But the lack of compassion, the lack of rachmanut, and the lack of hakarat hatov, that is something that God cannot tolerate within his people. In fact, the Gemara even tells us, if you see a Jew who does not demonstrate compassion and humility, that raises a question of whether he's truly Jewish. Not for us to judge, but he does say that Ad Kedei Kach, that perhaps he's not Jewish, because he doesn't have that midah. In fact, it's a beautiful thought. I've said this before, I'll repeat it again. Why Jews are called Yehudim? Because after all, Yehuda is really only one tribe. Now, in most of Chumash and in most of Tanakh, Bnei Yisrael, children of Israel, who is Yaakov. But in the book of Esther, and certainly in later books, we are called Yehudim, Jews. Why are we called Yehudim? Now, the simple explanation is, well, Jews. The Yehuda was the royal tribe, it was the largest tribe.
He came to the Benjamin, when Joseph wanted to hold him as a slave.
Okay, he volunteered. Well, that could be. It could be the devotion. But the Sfat Damas says the following idea. He says, if you look in the Chumash, Yehuda was Leah's fourth son. And why did she call him Yehuda? From the word gratitude.
Okay.
Hapam, now, Odeh et Hashem. I thank God. Now, why did she express gratitude only for son number four? She already had Reuven, Shimon, Levi. Now, some learn, well, if you look at the names, you can see a steady note of resignation in Leah's attitude, because she has son number one, Reuven, which is C. Now God sees me, my husband will love me. Didn't work, apparently. Shimon, God has heard my pain. Levi, now my husband will accompany me. That doesn't work. She finally says, I'll be happy for what I have. You know, it's kind of saying, you know, that is one way of looking at it. It's kind of a resignation. In other words, I'll be happy with my children, because she felt that perhaps there was not the optimal happiness with her husband. But the other interpretation, Rashi says, is the following. Yaakov has four wives, and the Imahot know there will be 12 sons, 12 Shvatim. That's known with prophecy. So if you divide 12 divided by 4, each wife is entitled to get 3 sons. When you get something that you think is coming to you, you don't feel grateful because it's coming to you. When she has number 4, she's gotten more than she deserves. And what do you feel when you get more than you deserve? Gratitude. So the Sfat Emet, one of the great Hasidic masters, says the following. Every Jew is called Yehudi because we must go through life with the attitude that God has given me more than I deserve. Instead of being bitter over what we perceive not to have in our lives, we have to feel grateful for what it is that Hashem has given us. And I think this is exemplified very clearly in the Amon and the Moav pasuk. Why are they excluded? They are excluded not because, you know, they were our enemies, and not because they waged war, but because they didn't have the compassion and the gratitude to give us the food and water. Now, the one issue, of course, that everyone's going to raise is, well, wait a second here. Rut is a Moabite, and Rut married Boaz, and from Rut, the great-grandson of Rut, is King David, David HaMelech, which means all the Jewish kings, and Mashiach.
And Mashiach.
Mashiach come from Rut. Well, there is a twist in this halacha, a very interesting halacha. The Gemara discusses this, and the Gemara says, the prohibition against the Ammonite or the Moabite converts marrying only applies to the male of the species. It does not apply to the female of the species. The female Moabites, such as Rut, and the female Ammonite, because actually Shlomo HaMelech married Naama from Ammonite, and according to tradition, that was a permissible union. Meaning we have a drasha, only a male Moabi and not a female. And the reason the Gemara says is because we can only criticize the males for not offering water, because they could be expected to go out and greet a foreign army. We could not condemn the females because it would not be modest for them to do so. Although, once again, obviously the motivation of the Moabite women was not modesty, because the Torah says that they actually enticed Jewish people into adultery. But the point is that the act itself, you see, in other words, that the act of not going forward was a modest act, although that was not their motive, and God rewards you for that. So what's interesting, now I want to point out though, that for hundreds and hundreds of years, this was not a well-known halakha. We will find indeed that people cast aspersions on Boaz for marrying Ruth, especially since Boaz died very shortly afterwards. People go, oh, you see, he married Moab. People cast aspersions on David, being descended from Ruth. So the point is that this halakha was not known at all because of a dearth of Moabite converts. There weren't exactly that many Moabite women who wanted to convert. And in fact, the reason why Shmuel wrote the book of Ruth, and he is considered to be the author, is he wanted to legitimize David HaMelech's lineage by showing that the marriage to Ruth was authorized by the great leaders of the generation.
But wouldn't it have been a moot point anyway? Ruth was converted prior to her marriage to Boaz, and once you're converted, longer what you were?
No, but you see, that can't be the case, because when the Torah says a Moabite cannot marry, it clearly doesn't mean an unconverted Moabite, because you couldn't
marry
any
non-Jew. Anyway.
The Torah is saying, even if they convert, we don't accept them. Which is going right. And that we don't apply to the woman. Okay? So that's what Ammon and Moab is. In which time?
At the time of
Well,
basically you're born in the tribe, the north of the tribe is where you're born in Boaz.
Well, in fact, in the book of Ruth, we identify elements of conversion. In Naomi, remember Ruth's very famous speech where you go, I want to go, your God is my God, your nation is my nation. That is essentially the rudiments of conversion and this desire to attach yourself to the Jewish people. Now, of course, there's a whole interesting story. If we ever do Ruth, we can go over that. And that is, it seems that Ruth did not become Jewish until after her husband died, and she goes back to the army. Does that mean that her husband married a non-Jewish woman? Right? And that raises the whole question. When did Ruth convert? Now, if you're going to posit a conversion earlier, then why is Naomi telling them to go home? They've already become part of the Jewish people. It's the whole question exactly. When was there if there was a conversion, when was there a conversion? But that's the issue of Jew versus non-Jew. But the issue of the Moabite is not an issue, because that Moabite law does not apply to the women.
Would you tell us again, please, how the child
expressed that? Yes. No, it's simply this. The Imahot knew ahead of time there will be 12 tribes. There are four of them, four women. So they figure each of us are entitled to get three. So when you get what you think is coming to you, you don't feel gratitude. So for the first three, she didn't express gratitude. For number four, I beat the odds. So every Jew has to feel God has given me more. And this is really a very, very fundamental lesson. again, it's unfortunate. One of the unfortunate aspects of being raised in comfort and affluence is that one often does not have a sense of gratitude for simple things. I mean, I remember when I was in Israel for a year, and you know, some of the neighbors I was with were really very, very, you know, poor people. And if five children got one ice cream cone, and we shared with each other, there was a lot of excitement. They really, really, they were very appreciative of it. And you'd think, you know, how would that wouldn't fly in a typical, you know, even if you give somebody their own ice cream cone, they may say, I want another one or something else. So the concept of appreciating what you have is something that's a very, very important mitzvah. In fact, even the mitzvah of honoring parents. You know, people ask the question of the famous division of the Ten Commandments is the first five are supposed to be between man and God. And the second five are supposed to be between man and man. That's the famous division. But the one question everyone asks is the fifth commandment. See, the first four are indeed between Adam l'makom. Believe in God, don't have other idols, don't take God's name in vain, observe the Shabbat, that's fine. But the fifth one is honor your father and mother. Now one would have thought honor your father and mother is more of a Ben Adam l'chaveiro more than a Ben Adam l'makom, right? So why is it, so it ought to be a four and six, right? But the answer is that the idea of the fifth commandment is to inculcate within our hearts gratitude for those who give us life. So even if, you know, even if one's parent did very little other than give them life, that's a gratitude too, because whatever you can accomplish is because you were given life. And the idea is, by developing that midah of gratitude towards the human beings who gave you life, your heart can now feel gratitude towards God who gives us life and everything else. And therefore, it really leads to a Ben Adam l'Mako. It is the idea of appreciating and loving God by the love and appreciation we feel towards our parents. Although it's been pointed out, the Torah does not command us to love our parents. It's a very, very interesting idea. So some people say, gee, what type of Torah is that? The answer is no, the Torah is going further. If the Torah would say, love your parents, a person who has a difficult relationship might say, well, I can't do that. But if God says, you have to honor them even if you don't love them, you have no excuse, right? Now, the Torah is basically saying, I'm giving you something that everybody can do. And it's not up to your individual whim and feeling. So actually, it's making it much more of an absolute. Because if the Torah would be commanding emotions, people might say, well, I just don't have those feelings. The Torah's answer is, your feelings are not relevant at that stage. Hopefully, you should get to that stage, but if you don't, you got to behave decently anyway.
When I didn't want to eat, my mother used to say, my mother had one egg and divided it in four because you were four people. Uh-huh. Well, to teach me a lesson.
Okay, well, that's, yeah. Actually, that's what Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was a great, great rabbi in Israel. And he grew up in Yerushalayim in very grinding poverty. And they had like 10 children. They would have one chicken leg on Shabbos divided among their children. So he once told his younger brother, he says, you were born during the good years when we would divide an egg among us. When he would say growing up, they didn't even have that.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
Esau was also a descendant from Abraham.
Yeah.
So why were the Edomites treated different than...
Yes, yes. Very, very interesting. So the Ammonites and the Moabites, at least the male, are totally excluded.
Yeah.
Now, how do we treat Edomite converts? Edomite meaning those who are descended from Esau. The truth is there's a much more limited restriction, a little strange. They're not allowed to intermarry for three generations after their conversion. By that we mean, if an Edomite converts, he can only marry another Edomite convert. And if they have a child, that child marries another Edomite convert. And the grandchild can enter. So, in a sense, the Edomites are not as rejected. And I think the answer is the following. Because Esav is much more oppressive to us. And Esav has a legitimate grievance. In other words, Esav's grievances are legitimate. In other words, Esav's grievances are, Yaakov took away the brachas, Yaakov tricked me. So God says to the world, okay, you know, you got an argument. Moab has no grievance against us. There was only kindness. So you actually see that God, and I don't want to say condones, because it's not condemnation is too strong of a term, but God there's a certain element of understanding of cruelty when that was provoked by unfairness. And therefore the Edomites are not as condemned, ironically, as are the Ammonites and the Moabites. Even Amalek, of course, is descended from the Edomites. They, of course, are given a different status. But even Amalek, we mentioned, if an Amalek wants to convert sincerely, we do accept it, which we would not do for the Ammonite and the Moabite, at least the male. All right, so that's Ammon and Moab. Now, who is Midian? Who are the Midianites? Okay, the Midianites are a different people, although they commonly got together with the Moabites. Again, go back to the Chumash. The Midianites are also related to
us. Yitro.
Yes, Yitro. Yitro, of course, is a Midianite. But where do they come from? Midian are one of the children of Keturah. Yes, just in the Chumash. Remember who Keturah is? That after Sarah died, Abraham took a wife, and the name of his wife was Keturah, and he had a lot of children from Keturah, and one of those children was Midian. Now, what's interesting is, although the Torah seems to talk about Keturah as another wife, in fact, Rashi brings a midrash that says Keturah was another name for Hagar. Remember, he had sent Hagar away? When Sarah died, he brought Hagar back.
And Hagar was a mitzvah?
She was a mitzvah, that's correct.
Well,
obviously she had embraced Abraham's religion. She had undergone a conversion. Now, here is the thing. Why does Hagar have a new name, Keturah, all of a sudden? What's this new name? So Rashi says Keturah is related to the word Ketoret, incense. Her deeds were as pleasing as beautiful, beautiful aroma of incense, meaning she had become a righteous woman. And according to this, therefore, Midian and Yishmael are actually full siblings. Right? Yishmael is from Hagar, Midian is from Keturah. But if Midian and Hagar, if Keturah and Hagar are the same person, that means the Midianites would be related to the Ishmaelites, which are the Arab nations. But be it as it may, Midian is a descendant of Abraham, and in a sense, therefore, we are more closely related to the Midianites than we even are to the Moabites. Because the Moabites are Lot's descendants, the Midianites are Abraham's descendants.
Keturah come from what?
Ketoret, incense. Ketoret. That's the burning of Kuf, Tet, Vav, Reish, Tav. Ketoret. So these are the Midianites. Now, interestingly enough, the Midianites, there is no restriction. If they want to convert to Judaism, we accept them. And of course, we know there is at least one very, very prominent Midianite convert. And that, of course, is Yitro. Right? Moshe married a Midianite woman. And there are other Midianites as well. So Midian, although in the book of Shoftim, they oppressed us as a nation various times, there were a number of prominent Midianites who had actually embraced. Right, so now you know a little bit. The Moabites, the Ammonites, the Midianites, and I think we mentioned the other day the Philistines, who are not mentioned here, but the Plishtim arrived with Shimshon. We're going to see that. And the Philistines, interestingly enough, never really occupied the Jewish people. Rather, the Philistines were much more plunderers and bandits, meaning, and if you remember, the Plishtim came from Crete, kind of like, right? And they were marauders along the Mediterranean coast, and they established a number of enclaves. The five coastal cities, Ashkelon, Gat, Ekron, I don't remember the other, but we'll see them. Ashdod, and there was one more. Okay, we'll see. But basically, their cities were on the Mediterranean coast, and they were marauders, and they were a mix of Canaanite stock, though they did originally. So it seems to be, perhaps they originated from Canaan, went to Crete or Sicily, and then went back and established beachheads on the Mediterranean coast. So they never were an occupying nation, but they were certainly a very, very sore spot. So, for example, not only during the period of the Judges, but even in the reigns of David HaMelech, right, the Plishtim were a common problem, Goliath, etc., and of course the very name Palestine, the Roman name for Israel, comes from Plishtim, Palestine.
You consider Ammon and Moab and Midian as coming from Abram? And by the time of the Assyrian Mizraim, there were about 400 years that those nations had a chance of growing. Yet they were already quite large. How did that be?
Well, again, I don't know if they were necessarily quite large. They did become powerful, warlike. They may have had a lot of cities that they conquered, and the people that were they conquered became part of their armies. There could have been a lot of mercenaries. You could theoretically establish a powerful with a relatively small number of indigenous native people simply by assimilating those that could conquer into your city-state. I don't know. It's true that the Jewish people were blessed with an extraordinary population growth. The question is, you're raising the question, if these other nations are not much older than the Jewish people, then based on normal population growth, they should have been much smaller. So why are they able to oppress the Jews? I think it's an interesting question. Because comparatively, their population should have been much smaller. I don't have a definitive answer other than saying perhaps they were confederations. Yeah.
When did the Arab become synonymous with the
Gemara? The Gemara seems to already, in Talmudic times, that seems to have been the identification. Now, we're not saying they're pure Yishmaelites. Obviously, there's intermingling and the like over hundreds and hundreds of years. But the Torah describes Yishmael as a wanderer. Therefore, the association of the Bedouin with Yishmael was made at a very early time. Yeah, okay.
But the Arabs at this moment, because probably the Greeks and those Africans have killed themselves Arabs, but they were all there. They were
okay. Yes, and that's
Muslims,
correct.
But
no, that's correct. Obviously, Islam has nothing to do with this, because Islam came much, much later. Yeah, and the concept of Arab and what is an Arab is a difficult definition. But I think the concept was that the original Bedouin tribes are those that would connect to Ishmael, not necessarily the other Arab groups. Yeah. Okay. Now, just to flesh out a few details, in Perek Dalet in Hay. I'm sorry. Go back a little bit. We talked about Othniel in some detail, and we had mentioned Ehud ben Gera, who assassinated Eglon, the king of Moab. I think I had mentioned, interestingly enough, that Eglon was either the father or the grandfather of Rut and Orpah. Although it doesn't quite fit the years, because Ehud is at the relatively beginning of the Shoftim, and Boaz is towards the end, so you have a problem with working that out. But the Gemara says the following point, that how did a guy like Eglon, a degenerate like Eglon, an oppressive king like Eglon, merit that he should be the ancestor of David and Mashiach? And it says, because when Ehud came to him, and Ehud came in the guise of having a message, I have a message from God to give you, and Eglon stood up, and he took three steps forward, and then the knife got stuck in his gut. It says, in the merit of the three steps that he took to give honor to God, he merited that his descendants would become the kings of Israel. The concept of Hashem rewarding the most insignificant gesture in a very, very powerful way. By the way, I mentioned Ruth and Orpah were sisters. Now, in the book of Ruth, it does not say that. In the book of Ruth, it just says, Naomi had two sons, and one took Ruth, one took Orpah. But according to Chazal, again, and they prove it from verses in Chronicles, Ruth and Orpah were actually sisters. And indeed, Orpah's descendant was Goliath. And Ruth's descendant was David. And David against Goliath was kind of Ruth against Orpah. Mm-hmm. And of course, the word Orpah... That's right, sibling rivalry, that's right. And the word Orpah, by the way, the names are very revealing. Because Oreth is the back of your neck. When you talk about a stiff-necked people, Am Kishay Oreth, that means you turn your neck, you don't listen to somebody. And Orpah turned her back on Oreth. Roots, yeah, that's a little more difficult to parse, but Roots comes from the word Raven, which is to saturate or to satisfy. And that is a divine illusion that from Rut will come David HaMelech, who will satisfy, saturate God with words of praise in the Tehillim. Now, this is always a question people might ask. Well, wait a second here. we're giving these meanings to Ruth and Orpah. I mean, Ruth and Orpah were their Moabite names that were given by Mrs. Eglon or whoever it was. She had in mind Orpah and Ruth. Like, what's going on? Well, here you have to understand the idea, and that is, certainly the Midrash is not saying that their parents had these things in mind. But rather, the concept is, God causes people to be named certain names for reasons that we don't know ourselves. If you name your child, the Ari writes that the name that you give a child is a prophecy from God as to some aspect of that child's nature. Now, you don't know what it is, and you're naming him after a parent, a grandparent, or a cousin, or an event. But why did God cause you to think about that? Is because there's some aspect of that name that is reflected. I even heard this said, this is an interesting question, I don't know if it ever happened to you. I was at a brit, you know, boys are named at a brit milah. So I was at a brit, and the moel who announced the name, or the rabbi who announced the name, didn't announce the name that the parents told them to announce. So either they didn't hear it. For example, you whispered to the moel, the child's name is Shalom. And the moel says Shlomo. And the parent says, no, Shalom. So the rabbi who was at the brit said, once the name was announced, that is the divine decree. It is God's will that that be the person. You cannot change it. Because if an accident happened, that was the intention of Hashem, that there be an accident. Now, I was at the exact same rabbi, and the exact same thing happened. The rabbi said he could change this. I'm not sure.
You like the other name better.
I have inconsistent precedents regarding this matter. But I want to say this, that sometimes stories happen like this, where a grandfather was doing the naming, and the grandfather very much wanted the child to be called after his parents. The parents had agreed it would be called after someone else. So the grandfather just, changed the name. So these things can happen. But there is this idea of nevuah, and I'm suggesting that when Midrashim tell us, oh, Ruth means this and Orpah means this, they are certainly not describing a conscious thought that their parents had. But why did God put that name in their minds? I'm sorry. That's another. That's also a very good possibility. In Tanakh, that's a very excellent point. In Tanakh, there is a tremendous fluidity of names. You know, we look at people as having your name. In Tanakh, names are always switched to reflect personality, character. So you're correct. Ruth and Orpah didn't even have to be their birth names. They are names based on their character and personality. That's an excellent point, and that's entirely possible. But this is the idea of the importance of a name. In fact, there's a whole discussion, when the Jews were taken out of Egypt, they were on the 49th level of impurity. They really were not deserving of redemption. But they had a few merits. And one of their merits was they didn't change their language. They spoke Hebrew. And they didn't change their names. They kept Jewish names, Hebrew names. So that's a zechut. It's a very important to have a Hebrew name. So the question becomes, well, in an ideal world, you know, most people have, an English name and a Hebrew name. They have two names. Is that ideal, or should we only name our children with what is called a Shem Kodesh, a holy name? Abraham, you shouldn't call it, right? So I had always thought, for most of my life, that the ideal situation is only a Hebrew name. But we have English names too, but ideally you should only give yourself a Hebrew name. Actually, but I recently came across the fact that there were many, many Jewish communities, Hasidic communities, that took the position, the idea that you should not use your holy name in profane affairs. And they actually had a point of having a secular name. And there was actually an actual theological argument that for business affairs one should not use the Lashon HaKodesh.
Rabbi, was it the secular name, was it a Jewish secular name, or did they change it to, if they were living in, a Christian society, because everyone in the country
Right. Although now we have Bush's press secretary, Ari Fleischer, you have a nice Hebrew name in the middle. But,
I have an Arabic name and a Hebrew name.
Well, what you see is, See, this explains it again, because when you read sometimes commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch by, you know, great rabbis, you have these strange names like Rav Sigmund or Rav, things that are not Jewish names at all, German names, whatever it is, and this is in the rabbinic writings themselves. So apparently there was a concept of what's called a Shem Chol, a profane name, along with a Shem Kodesh. So apparently there are two schools of thought. There are those indeed that say, ideally, your name should only be your Shem Kodesh. You should not use secular names. There are others that say there's actually a point in using a secular name.
I noticed among some Hasidim that they use the middle name. Even like Rob Weinberg used his middle name.
Yes. Was that because of a Hasidic thing or because he less liked his middle name more?
I'm not sure. I don't know, but I see a lot of that. I mean, I don't mean just him.
I've been noticing it too, yeah.
If that's the relationship to what you were saying.
Well, I'm not sure how it would be, because the middle name is just as holy as the first name.
I know, but the first...
In other words, that's the bris name. You don't want to use the bris name.
The first name would be used when they call each
other. Yeah, well, maybe there's a concept of giving it a special distinction. Now, this raises problems, by the way, because when you write things like a get, divorce, a get has to contain the full names by which you're known as, and if you're predominantly known by a secular name, you actually have to spell out the